Welcome to On Delmarva. I'm your host, Mark Steiner. Join us each week right here on Public Radio Delmarva to hear the stories that impact the land and the communities of the peninsula. Up first on this week's show, we continue our series interviewing candidates who are running for office to represent Maryland's Eastern Shore. Former Governor Bob Ehrlich joins us to drill down on the issues that affect Delmarva, from rehabilitating the oyster population in the bay to looking at the future of development. We've invited Governor Martin O'Malley to join us for an upcoming episode, so tune in soon to hear his take on the topics that matter most to you. In the second half of the show, join us for a conversation with Professor Mike Lewis, an environmental historian from Salisbury University. We'll talk about some familiar Delmarva landscapes and how they and the communities that live in and around them have changed over time. First, we'll join WEA traffic to check on the roads and make sure you all get home safe. And then we'll be back in conversation with former Governor Robert Ehrlich for this week's On Delmarva. I'm Mark Steiner for On Delmarva, and during this election cycle, we are talking to a lot of men and women who are running for office who want to represent you here on Delmarva, at least the Maryland part of Delmarva during this election. And right now we are on the phone with Bob Ehrlich, of course, a Republican candidate for governor and former governor of the state of Maryland, trying to get that mansion back. So
the people own it, Mark.
I just couldn't resist. Sorry. Bob, welcome. It's good to talk to you. It's been a while.
My pleasure. Good to talk to you, Mark.
We're going to focus a lot of this on the issues facing Delmarva and particularly the eastern shore of Maryland on Delmarva. And there are so many things going on there in terms of the controversies about the future and which way we should go.
Yes.
First, let me let you just give us a general thought about what you see going on there and what you think are the key issues and what you're thinking about.
Mark, the shore and Delmarva generally are areas not necessarily well understood nor well analyzed on the other side of the bridge. The joke in the past has been it's a different state and all that, and that's not true, although there are fundamental differences with regard to that bridge on the western shore and eastern shore. Ways of life, more agrarian still, even in today. Issues that people care about are far different, quite frankly, on one side as opposed to the other. I have spent a lot of time on the shore during my 10 years in the state legislature as governor and as congressman, quite frankly. Although, Mark, in Congress, I did not represent Eastern Shore County, I still was a regular visitor. So as governor, I was down there a lot. Clearly, the major issues down there pertain to farms and the farm economy, watermen and the water quality, oysters, crabs, and tourism. And tourism is a major, not just Ocean City, Mark. We spent a lot of time during my tenure as governor trying to market other shore destinations. Come early, stay late. Remember that program where we try to get people to stop in Berlin or Cambridge? There's a lot of retail business in Maryland dependent on that tourism activity. A lot of small business owners on that shore. So it's a pretty conservative area of the state, no doubt about it, more rural. You have a lot of wealth moving into the shore, particularly upper midshore, that has been very interesting and has changed the dynamic in some mid-upper shore counties over the past 10 to 20 years. A lot of folks who are not Marylanders with second homes or, in fact, now first homes in Talbot County, in Queen Anne's County. That has changed some of the politics locally.
I'm talking about some of the specifics there on the shore. I mean, I'll run through a few ideas here, and you can just throw your positions out on them so that people can hear them. Governor O'Malley has a plan to replenish oyster beds, and it has caused some controversy, which is to create zones where people would not dredge for oysters so they can replenish the oysters for future years out. And it may require taking care and underwriting some of the oystermen and watermen during that period. And what are your thoughts on that?
Well, my thoughts would be what we did during our administration, which was move the ball forward, but also doing a more balanced approach. The reason every last waterman on the shore is supporting us in this race is the fact that the watermen were left out, not invited to the table, Mark, akin to the way farmers have been treated at some points in the past by various administrations. We understand there's certain real good bottom, and there's a lot of bad bottom out there. So obviously a more balanced approach with regard to the watermen that would allow some very fertile bottom to be used during this time makes sense to me. We had a lot of controversy with regard to power dredging, as you know, during my administration. My point has been, Mark, I like science. I believe in scientists, and I believe in science on these issues, whether it was the oyster and the Asian oyster or whatever it happens to be, crab harvest, you name it. But watermen also, in a very real sense, understand the science because they've practiced the science for 3, 4, 5 decades in many cases. So they have to be part of the solution, not demonized, not ostracized, and not marginalized.
But do you think that one of the arguments around the oysters and dredging is that there should be some beds that be left fallow so they can grow for the out year so that we don't...
Yeah, and I think the oystermen agree with that. It's right now that they're feeling as though they're not getting anything, and that, in effect, Mark, ends their way of life, ends their heritage, and really damages small business dependent on the continued viability of that industry.
In you're aware of this lawsuit, the battle in the courts between Purdue and some of the water keepers and others, and the Hudson family as well. That was the farm family that was who had the suit filed against them in terms of the nitrogen and phosphorus going into the bay and into the rivers. And I just want a couple of questions about that. I mean, people are going to have all kinds of opinions about that, but.
Yeah.
And we're going to be covering that pretty intensely over the next 6 months to a year on this program. But do you think that Purdue or Tyson, those companies, have as much responsibility as the farmers who work with them and for them or give their chickens to them for what happens in the runoff as the farmers do?
I think, and this sounds like a political answer, but I'm sorry, because it's just simply how I feel. I think we all have responsibility. They both have responsibility. I have not read the lawsuit from the water keepers. I know the water keepers are not necessarily favorably viewed by the farmers. I know that. But, as you know, we were a hyperactive administration on phosphorus and nitrogen. That's why we passed the Chesapeake Bay Restoration Act. Unfortunately, Governor O'Malley is running ads against that act, as you know. Against that fee increase, and it's all over the shore and all over Maryland TV, in fact. That bill impacted three very specific areas, septic upgrades, cover crops on the farm, and sewer treatment plant upgrades. And Mark, I keep track, literally, and because it's produced on a monthly, bi-monthly basis, of the pounds of phosphorus and nitrogen no longer flowing into that bay as a result of that bill. So I, again, the sort of approach we took during my first administration. I don't like lawsuits. I don't like litigious people. I don't like groups coming in and saying it's our way or the highway. I think they all have responsibility. I know Jim Purdue. I know those farmers. The farmers obviously are very, very supportive of me, and so is Jim. I don't like to divide on these issues. I don't like when farmers are marginalized or blamed. In fact, Mark, very relevant observation here. We came in, and there was a lot of distrust with regard to nutrient management plans on the farm. And by the end of my term, we had a 90-plus compliance. Now, you talk about saving phosphorus and nitrogen on the farm, no longer flowing into the bay. That's a pretty outstanding statistic.
In Somerset County, it's a county that...
relatively poor county.
A poor county where 42% of the population is African-American, yet in the entire history of that county, there's never been an African-American elected to a countywide office or given a job of any major responsibility inside the county government.
Mark, I believe, by the way,
go ahead.
I'm pretty sure this is true. I'm almost positive this is true. I picked the first African-American judge in the history of Maryland's Eastern Shore. So I'm well aware of some of the my staff is looking at me saying yeah. So
I think that is true. I think that
yeah,
is true.
Yeah.
In that county, the NAACP, the ACLU, and others launched an issue, put out a report, and a commission was started. And there's a lot of argument about how to redistrict that county to ensure African American representation. There's now even an African American is running for sheriff in that county. and nonpartisan. He's not either Republican nor Democrat. And I wonder your take on that. I mean, it's...
Well, you know, it's really interesting because I'm in a little bit of a catch-22 there, and you and I have had this discussion for many years, and I made this point on Larry Young's radio show a few weeks ago. The next governor is going to have a heavy hand in reapportionment. That's what happens every 10 years. And the governor has, although not the dispositive hand here, but a pretty relevant hand. So let's just say, whether Somerset County or Owings Mills, doesn't matter, that I go out of my way to create majority districts, in other words, African-American representation in the legislature, in Congress. Well, the white Democratic establishment then accuses me of packing black votes into certain districts to elect more Republicans. So you and I both understand what I'm saying. It's a very sensitive subject. It has profound repercussions for our representation and our future. So these are just simply factors that you weigh when you draw those lines. Am I cognizant of majority black areas wanting African-American representation? Sure. But I also don't want to get hit with the Mike Millers and the Mike Bushes and the white Democrat establishment so used to holding power in the state. Hey, Ehrlich's packing black votes in those areas to elect more Republican seats, which would be a byproduct, Mark.
Well, that's
a tough one, isn't it?
But a lot of the representation on the Eastern Shore is Republican already.
Well, I mean, that's true. But if you look statewide, there's no Republicans in Montgomery County. There's no Republicans in Prince George's County. So, I mean, my point is race is one factor, but it can't be the sole factor.
Let me see. It's a sidebar question on that, since you raised it. I mean, do you think that's a factor of the districting, or do you think that's a factor in some ways of the internal battles going on inside the Republican Party that in some ways were represented by...
I'm talking about the courts. I wasn't talking about politics.
Okay.
I'm familiar with some of the case law and race, geography, natural boundaries. They're all sort of legitimate benchmarks along the way that the courts have held when it comes to drawing those lines.
Because you had that. I mean, that split almost happened in your primary, but it didn't happen. I mean, you won the primary, obviously.
Well, Mark, you talk about reapportionment, the games people play. Don't forget what drove me in part to the governorship was the Democratic leadership drawing a line from the boardwalk to Ballyheen Court in Mays Chapel, near where you live today. And that was ridiculous. It was insane. It made no sense at all. But it was all about getting my house into that district.
I remember that.
So, I came home one night.
But you weren't. Wait, but you
lived in my district. I wakened the next day. I was still a member of Congress, but I didn't live in my district anymore.
But you weren't the only person it happened to. It happened to Ben Cardin, in the 3rd district.
I know. Remember, Republicans do it to the Democrats in other states. I understand that, too.
I mean, Ben Cardin had his district redone that way, too. But
he had the safest. He had the safest seat in the world, as you know, as well. So it wasn't that big a deal.
So when you look
at... Those lines are drawn... Ben Cardin had no complaint. Ben Cardin's district was ridiculous, you're right, but it was a safe Democratic seat.
It was ridiculous because they thought someone could take him on and beat him, but that's another story. We'll talk about that another day. Your take on the question of what the future of the Eastern Shore is going to be. I mean, there was an interesting event that happened a while back, not too long ago, in Wicomico County, where they wanted to change the laws to allow more development and allow farmers to sell the land. The farmers themselves were split between young and old farmers, and even though most people in county were terrified of more development, it passed anyway. And that's going to be a huge issue about what the Eastern Shore, what Delmarva is going to look like in the next 25 or 30 years.
Yeah, and I, as a general, you're right, and the general proposition is Delmarva will make that decision, subdivision by subdivision. I'm quite hopeful that, for the most part, the decision errs on the side of protecting the farmland. Whenever you get a chance to fly over the shore, drive around the shore, let alone fly over the shore, you're just taken back how beautiful the entire Eastern Shore is. And those decisions will be a function of the people you've just described and those local zoning decisions and local master plans. And to some extent, some input from the state concerning water tables and sustainable development and critical areas and all of the state laws that apply. So
Now, one last thing, Bob Berlich, before I let you run off to your next event in the slow traffic we have today. The Environmental Protection Agency just put out a plan about what they intend to do in the Chesapeake Bay watershed, we talked about on this show and others, and I wonder your take on that.
I'd rather the feds be a partner. I'd rather the feds help with the cash and help with technical expertise. I get concerned when the feds are a sheriff, because when the feds are a sheriff, they preempt those folks that you've described, you're getting to know, and we've been talking about on the show.
But isn't that part of the reason that the EPA was started to kind of, when things can't get done and the...
Well, yeah, but Mark, yeah, but that presupposes, presumption there is things can't get done.
But they haven't been getting done.
There's been a lot of good decisions made on that shore. That shore looks... I'm not saying there aren't issues, obviously, but that sheriff approach, particularly from Washington knows best, raises concerns with me.
So, how would you respond to them in terms of their of just the issue of how bad the water quality is among most rivers? Choptank kind of is.
Yeah, like our Corsica River project, which I loved, and we began during our administration. I absolutely love it. You take particular rivers, you focus all the technology, all the science, the federal dollars, the nonprofit dollars, the private sector dollars, and you take one by one, river by river, Corsica today, Back River next year, to get them off the endangered rivers list. To me, that makes a great deal of sense.
Bob Berlich, thanks so much. Travel safe on this rainy day.
My pleasure, Mark. Congratulations, and Godspeed, my friend.
Thank you. That was former Governor Robert Ehrlich, who's running against Governor Martin O'Malley to regain his old office. Stay with us after this very short break, and we'll take a look at how the landscapes of Delmarva have changed over time with Mike Lewis, an environmental historian from Salisbury University. You're listening to On Delmarva on WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, and we'll be right back. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. Welcome back to On Delmarva. I'm your host, Mark Steiner. Have you ever wondered what the places around Delmarva looked like decades ago, centuries ago? Well, recently I spoke with Salisbury University professor Mike Lewis about the environmental history of the Delmarva Peninsula. Mike Lewis is director of environmental studies at Salisbury University. He's also associate professor of history at that university and is known around town and campus as the environmental historian who does a lot of really interesting work and joins us here on Delmarva for today's program. And Mike Lewis, great to talk to you once again, and welcome.
Thank you. I'm glad to be able to talk with you.
So, Mike, for our listeners, just describe a bit about what it is you do and what you teach so they can understand more about you just very quickly.
I teach and study environmental history, and that means the history of interactions between people and societies and their landscapes. And those interactions go in two directions. It's how people attempt to shape landscapes for their own purposes, and how landscapes also can shape human cultures and human societies that emerge on them. So we include things which might be linked to geography, biology, and ecology, but then also traditional history. And we just look for these connections between the environment or the natural world and the people who live in them.
So one of the things you said in our conversations by email yesterday before we had this conversation was how you like to approach your approach to the kind of questions you want to raise about the history. And I'm very interested about, as we explore on Delmarva, the whole questions and notions of agriculture and where it's come from and towns and communities and where they've come from, how they've changed. It seems to me that this has been a really fascinating history on the eastern shore of fluid change, that nothing remains static.
Absolutely. And I moved here in 2000, and as soon as I moved to the area, I began to study the history of primarily the lower shore here in Delmarva. And I was fascinated by the variety of periods that you could see, distinct periods in the history of the region, as people attempted to make a living off the landscape and how that shaped what happened here. It's something that I've been getting my students involved with, and so we do research seminars where we'll focus on agriculture, on forestry, on the environmental history of the Wicomico River. And we go back through the records, and we do oral histories, and we look at maps, and we try to figure out some of the changes that have occurred on Delmarva. And one of the most striking things that all of us have noticed as we look at this is how incredibly ephemeral human landscapes, cultural landscapes, can be. One of my favorite examples is we go down to Furnace Town, down towards Snow Hill, and I'll take students out and we'll walk through the landscape there and go past the Nature Conservancy site. And it's a beautiful forest. There are birds singing in the trees. It's just absolutely a lovely place. And then we try to imagine it 150 years ago when it was an industrial wasteland, when it was deforested for miles in every direction. There were huge piles of slag, you know, literally hundreds of tons of slag that had been just dumped in the swamp. It was a desolate landscape in the 1850s. And to imagine that landscape in the 1850s becoming the landscape that we enjoy and appreciate now, it's striking. And I ask my students as we drive down Highway 13, which is the central road going through the middle of Salisbury and up the Delmarva Peninsula, it's hard to imagine looking at, for example, some of the large strip malls and some of the more heavily human-modified landscapes on Highway 13, and to imagine it 150 years in the future as a nature conservancy site. It seems almost unfathomable.
That's interesting. So I'm one of the things I am curious about to touch on a little bit is, what does it say to you about all the kind of battles and struggles we see now going on about the nitrogen, the phosphates, the pollution falling into the waterways and changing the nature of that, and how that where farming is now is, and to compare to where it once was, about the growth of towns? And if you look at the kind of battle lines in Delmarva now, you almost have to have hope, I guess, in some sense, for the future, as a historian looking back and seeing the changes that have come over the last 100 years and how it's gone back and forth.
It has. And one of the things that's most striking is the unpredictability of how these changes will occur. There are, however, also changes which, as they occur, there's no going back. We will never again have the complete spectrum of species of mammals, for example, on Delmarva that we had 300 years ago. Most people probably are happy not to have black bears walking through the Wicomico County Forest, but you know we would have had them 300 years ago. So some changes are by and large not going to go back, at least in any kind of human scale of time. And so when we talk about things going on with the bay, when we talk about phosphorus and nitrogen, or we talk about species decline, fisheries that are being exploited, sure, there is a sense that we don't know what might happen 100 years from now. We don't know what might happen 200 years from now, certainly. But there is a sense that there are some changes that we can make which will make certain future possibilities impossible. And that's what's tricky, is to try to determine which options we want to keep open for the bay. What possibilities do we want to still be there for our grandchildren, and which ones are less crucial that we keep available?
So before we jump into that, what other animals are we missing?
Oh, my. Well, we would have had the wolves. We would have had all sorts of small mammals, which we've got a biologist here at Salisbury University, Aaron Hoag, who he studies small mammals, and he's trying to find out when we lost some of the small mammals on Delmarva, species such as the weasel families, what's going on with bobcat populations. Beavers, as you know, we lost for a good while, but they're actually coming back now. So we have beavers coming back into Delmarva and many of the rivers on the shore. Cougars would have been in the upper part of Delmarva for sure. There are any number of fish species which are either locally extinct or just not found anymore. Students are always blown away when I talk about the vibrant caviar fishery in Baltimore in the 1800s. It just seems so utterly foreign to us now.
From all the sturgeon that used to live in the bay.
That's right, from the sturgeon that once would have been coming up all of these bay rivers. We still have some of them, but obviously not anything close to enough of a population to supply a caviar industry.
So going back to this last few hundred years, one of the things that Tom Horton was talking to me about yesterday as we were planning some productions was that the history of agriculture on the shore is really interesting, and one of the things you can be sure of, it will never stay the same. Whether it was periods where we went through wheat to where we are now with corn, soy, and chickens, or before that, when he was younger in the 40s and in the 30s and 40s and 50s, it was dairy and chicken and truck farms and lots of vegetables. The changes in agriculture, can you talk a bit about that?
Absolutely. When you think about agriculture on the shore, there are, I think there are three big points of change. And the first of them, of course, is with European colonization of the shore. And the second is the transportation revolution that hit the lower shore in the 1860s and 1870s. And then the third would be following World War II, with a combination of factors which led to the emergence of the big three, corn, soybean, and poultry. If you look at each of those stages, the first period of European colonization, the British originally wanted Delmarva to be a fur reserve. They said that they didn't want to settle here as quickly as they settled on the western shore, and they wanted to exploit the Delmarva Peninsula for things like beaver. That didn't last long at all. They quickly wiped out many of the beaver populations, and so then they began to settle up the riverways. As they came up the rivers, there was a brief period of a few decades where on the lower shore they were able to grow a little bit of tobacco, but they quickly switched to grain crops like corn and wheat. In the 1740s, we had grain crops from Salisbury that were being shipped out the Wicomico River, down the Chesapeake Bay, and to the West Indies. And they would be sold there to the slave plantations growing the far more profitable crop of sugar. And so we were, even in the 1740s, participating in a kind of transatlantic global trade network that was supplying sugar to Europe using African slaves in the West Indies that were fed off of Delmarva grain. Now, ironically, that first wave of grain production, it led to heavy siltation in many rivers, and areas in central Delmarva, such as where Salisbury is now, they were more connected to global trade in the 1740s than they were in the 1840s. By the 1840s, it was far more difficult to get crops to market. Boats could no longer come all the way up to Salisbury. There are articles about in old local papers about heroic steamboat captains who, I think in 1855, one of them managed to catch a flood tide all the way up to Salisbury before his boat got grounded. There was a sense that the city was much more isolated at that time than it had been 100 years earlier. As you saw it with this isolation, farmers, they were able to grow fewer crops for export unless they lived right near the water, closer to the bay. That meant that the crops they were growing were primarily these non-perishable grain crops, but in lower numbers. 1860, the railroad reached the lower shore. It had been coming slowly down Delaware. And as the railroad came and the Civil War was completed, you saw a dramatic shift at that point to the production of perishable fruits and vegetables. And that's when you really see an explosion in the agriculture of strawberries, peaches, apples, pears, green beans, tomatoes, all of these sorts of things. They begin to be shipped primarily up to Philadelphia, New York, and Boston. We think today of Delmarva being connected to Baltimore, but really Philadelphia was much more the city of interest for merchants down here on the shore. In the 1870s and the 1880s, there was a New York Times correspondent who was assigned the job of just traveling through what at that time was called the peninsula and commenting on and reporting on the success of the fruit crops and the perishable vegetable crops throughout Delmarva for the audience in New York. And you can read breathless reports in the historic newspapers where he would say, "Today I visited the peach orchards of Worcester County and the peaches are going to be in perfect health in 1 week. Prepare your plates." And so there's this sense of Delmarva supplying these growing metropolitan regions up the eastern seaboard with these fruits and vegetables. It's hard to imagine a New York Times reporter assigned to Delmarva today. It's a very different world that we live in. But at that time, it was a crucial region for the city. interestingly, you know, this show is called On Delmarva. It wasn't called Delmarva until the late 1800s. Hmm. It was a marketing name that was created by agricultural interest on the shore to market Delmarva produce. Before that, it was usually just the peninsula. So with that second big thrust with the agriculture, you get the fruits, you get the vegetables, and you have a proliferation of smaller farms, which are nonetheless high profit farms. And you can argue that Delmarva becomes one of, if not the most important fruit and vegetable production area on the eastern seaboard for a number of decades. This persists all the way into the early 20th century. The canning industry is crucial through the early 20th century in places like Salisbury. You had the Delaney Corporation, run by John Delaney and then Ralph Delaney and some other members of the family. They were the Delaneys. One of them served as the president of the National Canning Association through the 30s. When frozen foods were introduced, Salisbury was at the forefront. We had one of the first frozen food plants in all of the United States. And one of the Delaneys was the vice president of the first National Frozen Food Association. In as late as 1953, Wicomico County was still the 13th largest fruit and vegetable producing county in the entire United States.
Hmm.
And so we think now of our importance for chicken, but at that time we were the 12th largest county in the U.S. for tomatoes. I think it was 16th for sweet potatoes, 22nd for green beans, 35th for strawberries, 46th for watermelons. This was in every way, as late as the 1950s, 53, it was a very diversified farm economy that was connected also with the canning and the frozen food industry. So that's the second big part of it, yes.
There was a time then when the shore could feed itself.
Itself and much of New York and Philadelphia and Boston as well.
So what do you think has changed?
Well, of course, we still can feed ourselves chicken, and we still feed much of the world chicken. It's just what we have chosen to use the land for. And I've actually been very, very interested in this question of how the corn, chicken, poultry complex arises in Delmarva. And as many of your listeners know, poultry really was introduced by accident by Mrs. Cecil Still in 1923 when she got too many baby chicks, and she was able to sell them when they grew to the size of being a broiler. In 1925, there were only 50,000 chicken in Delmarva that were being sold as broilers. 7 million by 1934, 48 million by 1941.
Wow.
By 2000, 616 million chicken that were being exported from Delmarva.
616 million chickens.
Yep, that's a lot of chicken. And so if you assume a population of, maybe 300,000 people on Delmarva, 350,000, we'll find out when the census comes out.
Uh-huh.
We can each eat quite a few chicken if we were trying to be self-sufficient in poultry production. So there's nothing that has been lost in terms of the productivity of the agricultural landscape of the shore. It's just been shifted. It's been shifted into growing different foods, different crops. And when you think about that, part of that is the kind of pull of the profitability of poultry, because it was a very profitable industry and it grew rapidly. The shore was well situated to grow poultry for places like New York. There was a growing demand for meat. The American diet changed dramatically between World War II and now, with the average family eating many more meals that included meat, and chicken, of course, being the least expensive of the meat options. But at the same time, and lesser understood, there was a shift in American migrant labor policies that occurred. If you look in 1953, when we were still the 13th largest fruit and vegetable producing county in America, at that point, we were relying upon migrant labor to do a lot of the harvesting of these crops, crops like strawberries, which are picked by hand, crops like tomatoes, which were still picked by hand at that time. We relied upon migrant labor. In the late 1950s, you start to see increased attention in Washington, D.C. by the federal government on exploitation of migrant laborers and also on the exploitation of child labor. And if you look at the Washington Post in this period, there are a number of articles by investigative reporters, or I guess this is really before the era of investigative reporters, but reporters from D.C. who would travel over to the peninsula, to Delmarva. It was the closest large agricultural region that they could reach. It was the easiest one for them to write about. And they would come and they would do exposés on migrant labor camps in Wicomico County or in Dorchester County or in Worcester County. And in these exposés, they would talk about the horrific living conditions, the bad pay. They would talk about children who were working in the fields rather than working in schools. It was an open secret that on, for example, with strawberry days, Wicomico County schools would shut down so everybody could go out and pick strawberries. There would be calls in the newspaper, and they would say, calling all volunteers, we need the strawberry crop to come in, or we need the tomato crop to come in. Businesses would shut down in Main Street. You would see the school children released. Everybody would go out, and there would be this burst of energy. By the late 1950s and the early 1960s, child labor was not looked upon as a particularly desirable thing. They wanted the children to stay in school, and the migrant labor conditions became a big concern. Under increasing attention from the federal government and a series of laws which were passed through the early 1960s, a number of shore farmers began to shift away from migrant labor-dependent crops towards crops like corn and soybean, which were easily mechanized, crops which could be easily harvested with mechanical means, and which there was this growing, apparently insatiable appetite for with the parallel growth in the poultry industry. So on one hand, you've got the pull of the poultry industry and the profits that are to be made there, but then you also had what appeared to be a end of the labor arrangements which made possible this whole fruit and vegetable system that had persisted for really about 70 or 80 years from the 1870s up to the 1950s.
And the migrants you're talking about were mostly African-Americans from the Eastern Shore, or was it mixed African-Americans and whites from the shore?
Oh, these were not just people from the shore. We had migrants even in the first decade of the 20th century coming up from the Caribbean. We had the newspaper would talk about this year we had a lot of folks from the Bahamas or people from Jamaica. There were migrants that were coming from throughout the American South, primarily the eastern seaboard, however. And so you would have people who would be moving up from Alabama, Mississippi, Georgia, Florida, the Carolinas, who would come up here into the peninsula during the prime picking season in midsummer.
When you talked earlier about wheat and the grain that kind of was destroying the rivers in many ways and creating sludge in the rivers, this issue of the state of the waterways within Delmarva, which are substantial, some of the most substantial in the nation, has been an ongoing thing. This is not just something new with the battles over development or battles over large chicken farms or battles over sewage plants and treatment plants. This is something that's been going on for a long time.
Yes, but in different ways. Mm-hmm. So for example, in the 1700s, I would hesitate to say that it was the wheat or the corn that was being planted that was destroying the rivers. It was really the deforestation that occurred and as the first step for planting any crop. And so as you would have siltation, you were having basically the soil eroding into the rivers and filling the rivers up. So this is a very different type of problem than the problem that is much more serious today, which is the overload of nutrients that are flowing into the rivers with the nitrogen and phosphorus as runoff from agricultural fields, but then also stormwater runoff from our urban areas. If you look in the 1700s, the farmers and the colonists on Delmarva were absolutely aware that they were silting up their rivers. They could not miss that because they were having increased difficulty getting their boats to sail up to their docks. And they were fairly aware that this siltation was occurring because of deforestation that was associated with them clearing out forests to plant crops. However, the economic benefit of clearing the land, planting the land and crops, and then being able to sell the crops, that outweighed any concern they had for the river. The solution that eventually emerged to this problem of siltation was not to change farming practices. It was, by the 1870s, you see a concerted effort right after the Civil War in the city of Salisbury. There was a community of businessmen, landowners, who pushed for two interlocked programs. One was they pushed to have a new county created, Wicomico County, out of Somerset and Worcester. And prior to that, Salisbury, the city of Salisbury, was divided between these two counties, and it was not the county seat of either Worcester or of Somerset County. And these businessmen believed that Salisbury should be the commercial center of the shore. And in order to be the commercial center of the shore, it needed to have its own political jurisdiction. It needed to have its own county. And so they pushed for that, and they succeeded by 1867 in creating Wicomico County. Having done that, then, they turned towards the newly created Army Corps of Engineers, and they pushed for the Army Corps to come to the Wicomico River and to dredge the river all the way up to the head of navigation in the town of Salisbury itself. And they succeeded. By 1872, the Army Corps of Engineers agreed to dredge the river. And at that point, then, Salisbury was unique on Delmarva in having perfect rail transportation going all the way up to Philadelphia and then connecting with the rest of the eastern seaboard. But then they also had now river transportation that could take them out into the bay up to Baltimore or down further south. And this dredging was repeated by the Army Corps of Engineers again in the 1890s and then a third time in 1901. Now it's almost perpetual. Almost every year you have some dredging going on in the Wicomico River. And so for them, the solution to silt was not to change the farming practices, but to persuade the federal government to nationalize the problem and use federal tax money to come in and dredge the river for their benefit. And they succeeded in that. As an interesting parallel, Princess Anne, which is an older city than Salisbury and the county seat of Somerset County, just 13 miles to the south of us, has the Monocacy River, which comes connects it to the bay. And in the 1700s, three-mast ships could sail up the Monocacy River into Princess Anne. If you visit Princess Anne today, that's almost incomprehensible. The river is so silted up and filled in, it looks like it's barely a canoe and kayak river. But they had three-mast ships. Yeah, it's just – it's hard to imagine.
That's amazing.
Princess Anne did not succeed in getting the Army Corps of Engineers to dredge. And that meant that as the kind of fruit and vegetable boom occurred in the latter half of the 19th century, Princess Anne became – a smaller community. Salisbury boomed, and Salisbury now is a far more important urban center than Princess Anne.
So I'm curious in all this, Mike Lewis, the way what you're describing is the shifts, as I think is as you put it to me in our last conversation. You describe it as the kind of the bust and boom cycles and the push and pull of the history that changes the nature of how we use our land and what industries get developed and how we farm, that this is all defined by many factors and forces over the history of Delmarva. And so as a historian and as somebody who cares deeply about Delmarva and looks at where the future may be going as well as a historian, what does this history tell you about where we are now and where we might be going?
Well, one reason that I enjoy being a historian is I often get to pass on the crystal ball and looking in the future. Yeah, but I will say that, of course, as a citizen and as a resident, my children were born here. I love this area. Of course, I'm concerned, and I try to think about what the future might hold. As you look at the way that people have used the landscape here to make a living over the course of hundreds of years and thousands, if you think of the Wicomico Indians and the Nanticoke Indians that were here before. When you look at lumber, they would cut trees. There would be periods of lumber. Economic output that would be quite high, and then the forest would be gone. They would plant crops. The soil would lose its fertility to some extent. Perhaps they would let the fields lie fallow or abandon the fields. Trees would grow back. There would be another period of lumber. They would change crops as one crop might become less profitable or as one market would close, another might open. And all of these changes, without any sort of intentionality in it, the people who were using the landscape were leaving open the future possibilities for the use of that landscape. They were maintaining what were fundamentally large fields, whether those fields would be at any given time covered in trees or strawberries or corn or wheat. They were still fields. I have to admit, I'm concerned by sprawl. I'm concerned by the it's not so much the population growth alone, it's the fact that in Delmarva our sprawl far outstrips the pace of population growth as a whole. And when you think about all the different uses that the landscape can be put to, when you get to the point of putting houses on them in one-acre lots on cul-de-sacs and former agricultural fields, that has a little bit more finality to it. It's difficult to go back from a neighborhood back to a forest or back to a strawberry field or back to a cornfield. Of course, we know that it can, and we know that people move. And over the long haul, over the centuries, absolutely, neighborhoods disappear, forests can return, people can move. But in the short and near term, the term of my life, my children's life, my grandchildren's life, it's highly unlikely that areas which become urban or suburban now will go back to anything else. That's what I'm worried about, because I see that as a constraining of future options for people to work with the land.
As a historian, what is it that you see about the growth today that changes the potential for change that you've seen in the history before us on Dormarva?
In the history before us, I mean, if you look at the uses of the landscape, you simply did not have as many developments occurring on as many prime forest or agricultural fields. You saw the communities were smaller, but they were also more centralized. Now, of course, if you drive through Dormarva, if you get on Highway 50 and cross the Bay Bridge and drive all the way to Ocean City, you have very few moments when you cannot see a housing development somewhere within sight of Highway 50. That's different. That's historically not the way that development had occurred and that the population growth had occurred on the shore. Even in the 10 years that I've been here, there's just a dramatic difference in the number of farm fields surrounding Salisbury that don't have housings popping up on them. As we imagine all the different crops that the land has grown here, I just worry that McMansions might be the last one.
That's very interesting. Do you think that the conversations we're having on Dormarva about farming and the future of agriculture is fundamentally different than we've had in the last 400 years, or is this just a progression that could also change one way or the other?
When I look back in Dormarva, particularly at the local papers, and I read the reports of the people who lived and worked here, you see far more evidence from the 1800s than you do from the 1700s, obviously. But there was not much of a concern about running out of land or about a scarcity of land. There were not many concerns about the possibility of there being an end of it of a very productive agricultural economy. I go back a year, though, and last year in Salisbury, there was a proposal to change the zoning ordinance in Wicomico County, which would have made it more difficult for large agricultural properties to have a small, dense cluster of houses developed on a portion of that property. There was an allowance in the zoning code which made it easier for people who were outside of the metro core to have these small developments on part of their agricultural land. And in the debate which led up to the final decision on this change into the zoning ordinance, there was a young man who was a farmer who stood up, and he had a petition with him which had been signed by other young farmers. And he was supporting the elimination of this density bonus that was allowed for farmland to be converted into houses.
Uh-huh.
And he spoke eloquently, and he said, for young farmers, we need land to farm. We need to have places that we can plant crops. We need to be able to continue to live the life that their families have been living here for, in many cases, generations. He was opposed by another group of farmers who wanted to maintain their right to maximize the kind of economic profitability of their land. And if that meant selling some of their land for housing developments, then so be it. And so you saw here in the agricultural community a divide between those who were perhaps in the latter third of their careers and who saw their land as their savings account, as their investment, as the potential source of financial stability for their later years and for their families. And then on the other side, you had young farmers who wanted to keep farming and who felt that in order to keep farming, they needed to have that land still be agricultural land, not land that was open for development. The young farmers lost. The people of Wicomico County, there was a survey done by the university in conjunction the Public Affairs and Civic Engagement Outreach group on campus had done a survey in which they interviewed people in Wicomico County and found that I think something close to 70% of residents were deeply concerned about sprawl and about development. This proposal was supported by many people in Wicomico County, but it ultimately lost, and the young farmers then are being sacrificed in this case, I fear.
That's interesting. So this also says a great deal about economics and power of growth and money. And because if you say 70% of the folks in the county from this study that was done were troubled by or opposed to this kind of sprawl, it clearly wasn't put to a vote. This was decided by a conference by whom?
Well, it was unanimously supported by the Planning and Zoning Board. And it was the final decision was left to the county council and to the county executive. And the county council and the county executive opposed it. And, yes, if you think about power and money, in the 2000 census, I just use this information to absolutely shock my students every year.
Mm-hmm. It'll shock us with it, too.
Okay, so most of our students are not from the shore. About a third of them, I think, are from Delmarva. The rest come here usually from the D.C., Baltimore, Philadelphia area.
Mm-hmm.
And their experience is that as they drive to Salisbury, as they drive through Salisbury, they're driving through a really rural area. So I ask them to guess from the 2000 census how many farmers, foresters, and fishermen lived in Wicomico County. And I tell them, to kind of help them get their head around the numbers, I tell them that in the 2000 census, Wicomico County had 84,644 people. So how many, I say, were identified in the census as working in forestry, fishing, and farming? And they usually come back with some number of thousands. The actual answer is 383.
Wow.
That's less than 1%, much less than 1%. The whole county, 383 people in farming, fishing, and forestry. That's it. That is staggering. Now, of course, that does not include agricultural industry people. So that does not include the people who work in the Purdue chicken plant that's right in downtown Salisbury. It doesn't include the people working in the Purdue office building. It also, I do not believe, would include recreational farmers or part-time farmers who have to have another job in order to make a living. But these are the full-time farmers. And so you're talking about a very small group of people who control a lot of land and a lot of economic power within the county.
And then,
but they do not represent anything close to a Democratic majority.
And then there's another power, the power of just the need for property taxes and the power of developers' money that wants to see that land zoned somewhere else so we can build.
That's right. And Tom Horton, as you know, has spoken very eloquently about the development lobby and the kind of development industrial complex.
Well, Mike Lewis, I want to say this has been a wonderful conversation, and look forward to many more on the course of On Delmarva.
Thank you. I appreciate it, Mark.
Thanks for tuning in to On Delmarva this week, and we'd love to hear your thoughts and ideas for upcoming shows and your critiques and ideas about what you've just heard. So please send them to comments@ondelmarva.org. And we hope you join us again next week. On Delmarva is a production of the Center for Emerging Media, made possible in part by the Town Creek Foundation. Our producers are Justin Levy and Christina Arison. We're engineered by Christopher Rank at Public Radio Delmarva, and thanks to Dave Bell at Clean Cuts for additional engineering. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.